Exodus chapter 4, verses 24 to 26. The eighth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on November 29, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 8, Exodus 4, 24 to 26, accompanies this talk.
We've gone 2 weeks now without any questions due to the verbosity of the speaker. So this week, my plan is to do two verses and then open it up for questions, and then we'll see how that goes. The bad thing about not getting to a question period is people forget their questions in the interim, and so you can't just restart that up again easily. But I thought that I would try to prime the pump a little bit at least by doing a couple verses, and then I want to open up to any questions that you've got. Okay, Exodus chapter 4, verse 24. Let me bring you up to date on where we left off. Moses has spent 40 years in the desert in Midian, taking care of his father-in-law's flocks. And then, after 40 years of doing that, God appears to him in a burning bush. And God speaks to him, and God says, I have seen the afflictions of my people Israel, and I am going to do something about it. I am going to liberate them from their slavery. Then, he says, and you, Moses, are going to be the instrument by which I will do that. And Moses is not attracted to the idea that Moses clearly had been hurt by the incidents just before he left Egypt, especially what was said by one of the Hebrews that he went to help. And so he is reluctant to go and offer himself as a leader to the people of Israel, thinking they will not accept it. So he lists four concerns. His first concern is, he says, who am I? God responds to each of these concerns. God's response to that one is, don't worry, I'll be with you. So he gives his second concern. His second concern is, who will I tell them sent me? And God's response to that is, I am Yahweh. And I think the essence of his answer is, I am the God of all. I am the God of all creation. I am the God of existence. And I am up to the task. Then his third concern is, well, what if they won't listen to me? What if they won't listen to the fact that you have sent me and take that seriously? And God says, well, I will address that by giving you three signs. The first one is you're going to take your staff and it will turn into a serpent and you'll turn it back. The second one, you'll take your whole arm, your healthy arm, stick it in the cloak, pull it out and it will be covered with leprosy. You'll stick it back in and pull it out and it will be whole again. And the third is you'll take some water from the Nile and pour it on dry ground, and it will turn to blood. And God says, if they won't listen to you, that you were sent by me, perhaps they will listen to the signs. Then Moses gives his fourth concern. I'm not eloquent. And last time I argued that I think what he's saying is I'm not persuasive. I have amended that. I think it's probably better to say I'm not impressive. I'm not impressive of speech. In any case, he says, I'm not eloquent. And God says, I made your mouth. I know what you can do, and I know what I can do through you. So that is not an issue. And Moses comes back to that and says, well, send whoever you will. And at that point, God becomes angry and says, I will send Aaron with you. He's a good talker. I will send him with you, and he will wail the socks off of him. So God has addressed all of the concerns that Moses raised. So Moses informs his father-in-law that he's going to Egypt, He prepares his family to go. And then as he's taking off, God once again speaks to him and says, I'm going to lead my people out of Egypt. Pharaoh's not going to like that. He's going to resist it. And God says, since he will not let my firstborn go, that is Israel, he's referring to the people of Israel as his firstborn. Since God won't let my firstborn go, I will kill his firstborn. In order to make it possible for you to go, I will kill his firstborn. And that's where the passage ends. And then what follows is one of the most bizarre passages in the Old Testament. I'll read it. Now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, you are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. At that time, she said, you are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. This is a very difficult passage. It's hard to know what the author is even trying to describe. And there are a lot of interpretations and a lot of ink has been used on trying to make sense of this. There are two terms in this passage that are not well attested elsewhere, so it's a little difficult to know for sure what is being described. One of those terms is bridegroom of blood, and the other one is circumcision. The noun circumcision here is not well attested elsewhere. Furthermore, the antecedents to the pronouns in this section are not clear. That is, the one to whom each pronoun refers, it's hard to know who that is. And the third is, it doesn't seem to fit into the context whatsoever. Okay. Given those difficulties, I'll give you my best guess as to what's going on here. First of all, I think that there are some loaded terms in this passage. What I mean by loaded terms is, it is words or phrases that have a lot of content, connotations that come along with those words. And one of the things that I am becoming increasingly aware of in my study of the Old Testament is there are a lot of such words. That you have to be paying attention to not just what is said literally, but what kinds of connotations have been formed around those words or phrases. And it's difficult to sort that out. It's difficult to get a good sense of what those are, but they're very important, I am now persuaded. One of those is the term on the way. The phrase on the way occurs quite a few times in the Old Testament. I became aware of this term when I was studying for the Summer Institute and I was looking at the life of Rachel. And this phrase becomes important there. And looking at the life of Rachel, I completely changed my mind as to how Rachel should be viewed in Genesis. Prior to my studying, I had seen Rachel as kind of a spoiled brat, that she was the pretty one, and she was used to having things her way, and she was barren and couldn't have children, and that became an obsession for her, and I was inclined to not give her any benefit of the doubt. But as I looked at it, I became convinced that the author of Genesis really wants us to see her life as being in parallel with Jacob's life, and that there are many features in Jacob's life that are repeated in Rachel's life. And one of the things that you see in Jacob is he starts out a deceiver and a cheat, but as time goes on, he begins to learn to trust God implicitly. And in particular, Jacob is devoted to the promises, that he is convinced that God is going to fulfill the promises that he has made, and that becomes extremely important to Jacob, such that we have this incident where he gets into a wrestling match with the angel. He's holding on to the angel. You won't let the angel go until the angel blesses him. And I think that's synonymous with fulfill the promises that you've made. Those are the blessings that had already been announced. With Rachel, it's harder to see that, but I think we are supposed to see her life as being in parallel and her going through that same transformation. And at the end of her life, it says that she died on the way to Bethlehem. That's where they were headed. That was their destination point. And she died on the way. And then it says, and she was buried on the way. And later, those two phrases are repeated when Jacob is remembering back to the incident. He repeats those two phrases. And I think what we are supposed to understand by that phrase, in the way, is that she had come to understand that the promises were of paramount importance, such that she wanted those with her whole being. And she died in the expectations, on the way, in the expectations that those promises would be fulfilled. So I think that's approximately what is being associated with that phrase, on the way. If that's true, and if that we can plug that in here, then what's being depicted is a Moses who has been, after having talked with God and having been convinced that he should go, that we have a Moses that's been reinvigorated, that his confidence in God has been restored, and he is now on the way, and that he is going to play a role in the promises being fulfilled, the promises that God had made to the people of Israel. There's another phrase, met, says that God met him. And my suspicion is that that is also a loaded term. It's not as clear to me what that means. This term, met, is an unarranged encounter, apparently. So there is something unexpected about this. And it is used sometimes in contexts where it's unexpected good and sometimes where it's unexpected bad. And here we have an unexpected bad. Okay, what happened in this first phrase, and it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. So apparently what has happened is there's something that's happened to Moses, and my best guess is he's become ill. And he is on the verge of death. And that is a disease that has been brought upon him by God. So God met him and sought to put him to death, gave him a fatal illness. It's just what you would have expected to happen after the passage before. It is interesting, and sought to kill him. It was just a little bit earlier that God said, now you can go back to Egypt because those who sought to kill you are no longer there. Well, it was Pharaoh's men that were seeking to kill Moses, and now it's God himself. Okay, so Zipporah does the obvious thing. She takes out a flint knife, and she circumcises Moses' son. It's her son's foreskin. The only son that's been mentioned so far is the firstborn, so that's Gershom. So she takes the flint knife, which is exactly the instrument that's supposed to be used for circumcision, and she cuts off the foreskin of Gershom. That means he was not already circumcised, which is interesting. We don't know how old he is. Circumcision was supposed to happen at the age of 8 days. We don't know when this happened. We don't know how old Gershom is. It is not unprecedented for circumcision to be delayed. Before the Israelites went into the land, all of those who were born while they were wandering in the wilderness were circumcised, which means that while they were wandering in the wilderness, that whole time, nobody was circumcised. And there's speculation as to why that was. Some say, well, it's because it was so unsanitary when they were moving from place to place in the desert that it would have been too dangerous to the life of the children to do that. That's speculation. I don't know if that's the case or not. I'm going to suggest another reason why this may not have happened. The law has not been given yet, of course, but according to the law, you would expect, I don't remember whether the law requires the priest to do it or whether it's the father to do it, but the mother would not be expected to do it. But that is presumably because Moses is too sick to perform that operation. Then she takes the foreskin that she has just cut off, and my translation says, and threw it at Moses' feet. There's no real justification for using that particular translation. Apparently the translator of this text is thinking that she is upset, that this is an emotional response. but I can see no reason why it should have been translated "threw it at his feet." It means literally, and this is what it says in the margin of my Bible, it says, "and made it touch at his feet." And that's more literally what it says. So she takes the foreskin that she's cut off and touches it to Moses' feet. And then she says, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me," and I'll come back to that. And then it says, "So he let him alone." The he here is apparently God, so God relents, and Moses returns to health. And then it says, "At that time she said," so it repeats, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." Okay, there are a number of terms in this section that occur before and that occur after, and I think that is the literary way of tying this passage together with those that come before and after. One is met. It says God met Moses in this passage. Later on, it says Moses met Aaron. We have mention of the son here, who is a firstborn, and that's curious, because just before this, the passage has said that God will kill the firstborn of Pharaoh. So we have the firstborn connection. And then that phrase, "sought to kill," I mentioned that Pharaoh sought to kill Moses, and here it says God sought to kill Moses. And there are others too. Sometimes it seems to me those are exegetically significant, and sometimes those are not, but they do tie it together literarily with the other passages. Okay, I think that there are essentially three reasons why this passage is here. The first is, I think we are to see a contrast of fates for the firstborn. Pharaoh's firstborn is going to have to die because of Pharaoh's stubbornness. That's what it is said in verse 23. But in this case, we also have a firstborn. It's Moses' firstborn. But it's Moses' firstborn has to shed blood in order to save Moses' life. The second reason I think that this passage is here is I think that it is intended to be a warning to Moses to take his mission very seriously. The assignment that he's been given, what he's supposed to do when he goes to Egypt, he is supposed to take that very seriously. Umberto Casuto says, with respect to this passage, that there is a resemblance between this passage and a passage in Numbers chapter 22. In that passage in Numbers, if you'll recall, the Israelites are about to enter into the promised land. They are going up the eastern side of the Jordan, and they come to Moab. The king of Moab is putting up resistance, and he wants the Israelites to be cursed. And so he asks a prophet, Balaam, to come and proclaim a curse on the people of Israel. Balaam says, "No, I'm not going to do that. I am not going to place a curse on the people of Israel." And Balak says, "Oh, no, you got to come. You got to come." And Balaam says, no, I'm not going to do it." And God comes to Balaam and says, "I want you to go." So Balaam says to Balak, "Okay, I'll go." And let me read. This is 22. I'll start with verse 20. "And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, 'If the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall you do.' So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab." Next verse. "But God was angry because he was going, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him." God has just told him to go, and now God's angry because he's going. And what happens here is the donkey that Balaam is riding three times refuses the commands that Balaam is giving it. It wanders off into a field one time, the next time it goes up against a wall, and the third time it just lays down. And each time it's because the donkey can see the angel of God ahead and knows that it would be dangerous to go any further. Balaam can't see the angel of God and is whipping the donkey, saying, "Go on, go on, go on." God then intervenes and explains to Balaam what is happening. Well, first the donkey speaks to Balaam and says, why are you beating on me? Haven't I always done whatever you've asked me to do, and now you're beating on me? And then it becomes clear that the donkey has been seeing the angel of the Lord and has been acting accordingly, and Balaam could not see it. And then he is charged to, the angel reminds him that he needs to do exactly as he has been commanded to do. So the whole incident is designed to impress upon Balaam the importance of doing exactly what he's been told to do by God. I think Casuto is right, that this is probably serving the same purpose, that this is a reminder to Moses that the mission that he has been sent to do is of extreme importance, and it is vital that he do exactly as God has told him to do and not vary from that. The other thing that I think is going on here is, as I have been arguing this, and I will continue to argue this, it seems to me that what happened with Moses as a result of his experience in Egypt, especially with the Hebrew at the end, that Moses was so deeply hurt by what happened that Moses has ceased to identify with the people of Israel. And I suspect that's why Gershom was not circumcised. That at this point, Moses is not fully identifying with the people of Israel. So he didn't even circumcise his son. In any case, I think what's happening now is that he is being called to fully identify with the people that he has been sent to save. And as a result, his son needs to be circumcised. And then the foreskin is touched to Moses' foot so that there's a sense in which he is identifying with this act of circumcision on his son. That is to say, he too is renewing his identification with the people of Israel. So in essence, this is kind of Moses' conversion experience, that he is re-identifying with Israel at this point. He had almost died, and I think what Zipporah is saying is, I almost lost my husband, but I got my husband anew. I got my bridegroom anew, as if raised from the dead. How? By virtue of the blood of the firstborn. In other words, Moses is now fully identified with Israel. He has made that commitment. He is one of them. And Moses is all in with respect to the mission. Okay, those were the verses I was going to do for sure. So I will take a break now. And any questions you have on this passage or anything in Exodus, I'd be willing to address as best I can.
Thanks, David.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, well, first of all, you mentioned that there is no antecedent for the pronouns. So
no clear. Surely there's an antecedent, but no clear.
Given that the verse prior to these was talking about the firstborn sons, could the hymn be the son, God, seeking to kill the firstborn son
right
on the road, et cetera, et cetera? Did you consider that?
I did, and couldn't get it to work. Because if you take that, if it's the firstborn then who has a fatal illness, then explaining why it's Zipporah that does the circumcision, then she touches it to Moses' foot, and then she calls him a bridegroom of blood. It just seems to me that it's harder to make that flow.
Well, both of the hymns could be the firstborn, if she's touching it to the firstborn's foot.
Mm-hmm. She cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet.
My translation has, Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his legs with it.
Oh, that could very well be. It could be that Moses has been put in here by the translator, because I was thinking that the name Moses doesn't appear in this passage.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I wonder if then the you are truly a bridegroom of blood is something about the recognizing the impact upon her family of the mission Moses has.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just speculating.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's interesting is it seems like there's a real parallel to the what's going to happen with the Passover and the angel, well, God coming with the intent of killing the firstborn and the marking of the doorposts with the blood for the angel to pass over.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Moses or the son marked with the blood from the foreskin, which seems to avert the death that's intended. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll come back to the antecedent of the pronoun him. There is no mention of his son prior to this. There's the mention of Pharaoh's firstborn, but there's no mention of Moses' firstborn.
Right.
So there's a difficult passage.
Yeah, it's tricky.
It is.
It's really
tricky. And there is one commentator who he speculates that in all likelihood, there was a fuller account of this that would have been passed down orally and that the readers of this would have known. And that this is just alluding to an event that they would have had a fuller understanding of. Maybe that's true, I don't know. But this description of what happened is extremely cursory.
I want to go back to 3:7.
Mm-hmm.
And when you covered that, I actually underlined my people because for some reason it really touched me.
Yep.
That God had already identified the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now the descendants, the family, as his people,
mm-hmm.
before Passover and before Pentecost, before he had adopted them out of Egypt, he's already said, they're my people.
Right.
He's already, I was just reading in the Psalms today when it talks about God will not abandon his inheritance. He really has plans for these people. But to identify that way was kind of amazing to me. And then he says, kind of like, I'm going to leave my domain with you. And we're going to go down into this other domain, Egypt, where there's like a dozen gods, each with his own domain. And one of them who claims to be the adopted son of the current ruling god. And I'm basically going to pay them no regard at all. Then I'm going to take you out of there to another land with these other tribes, each who have their own domains, with their god who supervises their domain. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to push them aside.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me, I don't really understand that long-term debate about the development of monotheism among the Hebrews, because this seems like he's saying, I'm it. I have such total disregard for the concept of man's gods that I'm even going to use their images of their gods to destroy their images of their gods.
Right.
And then I'm going to take you someplace else and push them out of the way too. It's like, it's thick. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think God was always a monotheist. But I think that it does seem to be the case that the patriarchs, their understanding does develop over time. I think that is true. And I think Moses' thinking is developing as to who God is and what drives him and what he's up to, all that sort of thing. It's the pieces are falling together for him, but he is learning as he goes along, I think. But you're right. From Genesis 1 on, God is it. And I think that's clearly the case.
And where he says, I'm going to take this people up from that land to a land of good and spacious land flowing with milk and date syrup, this people never actually got there.
Right. But one thing that's really important to see, I think, is in this history, God relates to the people of Israel as a person. And so it's kind of like the people of Israel are the cells of a body, but that body has an ongoing identity. It has a memory, that is history, and it learns things, et cetera, et cetera. And so from that perspective, it makes all kinds of sense for something to happen and the punishment be delayed for 50 years when a whole bunch of those people have already died. But from the biblical perspective, dealing with Israel as an entity, that makes all kinds of sense.
It continues generation to generation. That's an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it seems to be there, yeah.
I found it helpful the way you describe what it meant in the Rachel passage mm-hmm. for On the Way. And I didn't catch how you're seeing it in this passage. I might have zoned out, or maybe it could use a little better explanation. Well, but you were saying it was in the expectation of mm-hmm. something like that. So mm-hmm. if you could go over again.
Well, I think what we're seeing with Moses, that he is now on board with the assignment that has been given to him. And the assignment that has been given to him is to go to Egypt and be God's instrument in fulfilling the promises that God had made to Abraham 400 years earlier. So Moses is also motivated by and driven by that expectation of the promises that God has made.
And we're supposed to see Moses at this point being more that way than he used to be? Is that why that phrase is in there?
I do.
Okay.
Because when God first came to him and said, go to Egypt, Moses says, who am I? And then he's got three more concerns. He doesn't want to go. That he was so burned by what had happened that he does not want to take that on, even though I think he thought when he was in Egypt that that was what he was supposed to do. He had a privileged position given to him by God, a privileged position in the Egyptian setting where he was uniquely positioned to be able to help the people of Israel gain relief from their slavery. But then the response, when he tries to take action to fulfill that, the response is, who made you a prince or judge over me? And then the second one, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? And that so hurt him, he's given that up. He's gone into Midian. That's no longer a part of his thinking. So when God comes and says, I'm going to help you fulfill the calling that you thought you had 40 years ago, Moses is saying, I'm not the person. Send somebody else. So he has given that up. But it takes some persuasion on God's part to bring him around to where he's willing to accept that calling, I think. And I think what we're supposed to see here is he's okay with that calling. The next step that has to happen is he has to fully identify with his people.
Great, thank you.
Do you think the phrase bridegroom of blood could have anything to do with Moses' status as a murderer?
I hadn't considered that. I'd have to think, how would that fit in? What are you thinking?
I'm not quite sure. Wonder if maybe he has some latent guilt that God might hold him accountable for as he's entering into a somewhat sacred position among the people.
I'd have to think about that. I'm more inclined to associate with the circumcision because presumably there is blood involved there. That would be the closer connection and more obvious connection. So that's why I've taken it the way I have.
Okay.
So you've been exploring these places where you have to decide, I have a repetition of phrases or something that looks like it might be an allusion to something else or those sorts of things. And you have, in what we've seen so far, you've come down pretty strongly on seeing those in a lot of situations as significant. This repetition is not a coincidence,
right,
or you know, that sort of thing. This question is not intended as a challenge to that. I'm sympathetic with that, and I'm quite willing to take every one of them the way you're taking them, so I don't have any problem with it. But I just wanted to invite you, you've done it a little bit, but and maybe you don't have any more to say, but I just wanted to invite you to tell us how you think about that stuff. How do you decide? You mentioned there are some repetitions that you thought were exegetically significant, and some of them were just literary sort of tying things together. There is another possibility that it is just absolutely a coincidence and it doesn't have any significance at all.
Right.
So, and I'm not arguing that, but I'm
right.
There's always that question. On the one hand, I am growing more and more sympathetic to that sort of thing as I look at things. I do have in my own experience this backlog of reading scholars talking about various things, and they'll find some parallel to one thing or another, and immediately they start making these connections and, frankly, in a very unconvincing way, come up with all sorts of strange ideas. So the fact that there is some sort of a parallel or similarity or something is not always significant.
Right.
So what are you looking for when you make those decisions, I guess, is my question.
Well, let me explain how I've gotten to where I've gotten. It was primarily looking at Isaiah and then Jeremiah over the last few years. I had done a little bit looking at Genesis a long time ago and seeing that there were words that would be repeated. The fact that they were repeated in a passage seemed to have some significance. Then looking at Isaiah and Jeremiah, I became even more convinced that what is happening is the authors of the Old Testament are building on what came before them. And a word takes on connotations, as it is used, it takes on connotations that they are expecting the reader then to carry over into other instances where it occurs. Those connotations don't always carry over. Those connotations can be a complex set of connotations where one is appropriate and another is not appropriate. But I'm convinced that that phenomenon happens. Now, I used to discount it, especially when I read Umberto Casuto, because he looks at this sort of stuff all the time. And I'm not always convinced that what he's seeing has significance. And I discounted it because I thought, well, those are just common words. And so, of course, they're going to show up once in a while. And just because they show up once in a while doesn't mean that they are intended by the author to be related. But as I have been studying these works, I see more and more instances where if you see them as related, and if you see them carrying connotations, that the passage kind of falls out. It kind of falls together in a way that it otherwise would not. And when that happens a number of times, then you start becoming sensitive to that phenomenon. Now, the problem is knowing when that's happening and which connotations are being carried over into the other passage. And I don't know any way to do that except to experiment with it and see how you have to jiggle things so that all the pieces fall into place. So I would admit that what I'm doing here, to a certain extent, is jiggling. I'm not sure whether I've gotten all of the pieces to fall into place, but I think that that is a doable thing. It's just hard to get all of them to fall into place and feel confident that that's what you've done. But I think that when they do all fall into place, that it will be so clear that one can get confidence, yes, that is what was intended.
Okay, so let me just repeat back to you. I heard two things. One of them was...
I said a whole bunch of things.
But I only heard two of them.
Oh, okay.
In regard to this question of how you would decide, ultimately, one is related to, by bringing those factors in, it pulls the text together in a way that otherwise it doesn't seem to, and you gain confidence in that approach as you feel that you see it repeated. Seeing that one time, you might be more dubious as to whether you're doing it right, but if you see it a number of times, then it gives you confidence that the author intended to do such a thing.
Yes, yes.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. When I was an early Bible student, I always associated circumcision with the Mosaic Covenant. So one day I was studying, I was restudying Genesis, and suddenly it dawned on me, hey, this comes way before the Mosaic Covenant, right, as an identification of the people, and even Ishmael and his sons were circumcised. I don't really have a question in there, but would you like to make a comment about that as a symbol for identifying as one of the people of God? Because I know it's a big issue in the New Testament that that's not really required for the Gentiles, but it does seem that anyone arguing for circumcision would have a lot of basis for maybe making the case for the other side. Mm-hmm. So do you think it's significant that it comes up right now? Other than, I guess you did say it's significant because it's an act that where Moses is identifying with his people, but it seems like uniquely important. Like, he didn't pick anything else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you like to make a comment? Or...
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's significant. I think that it's an act that involves pain, that there's a cost involved, that blood is spilled, that this is an act that is serious and permanent.
Did you see this as a foreshadowing of the Messiah?
Potentially. That's one of the places where I have to do some more jiggling first. Because I'm not really ready to go there, but I'm wondering if all the pieces were in place, if it would be some kind of foreshadowing of that. I'm not sure at this point.
Is it significant that someone else does it?
I think that is an interesting thing, yes, that someone else is the one who suffers for Moses to make this identification. That is interesting.
Is it significant that the person in responsibility and authority does it to their child? Child makes no choice. The child just grows up finding out he's been chosen. Someone else put this on me. Mm-hmm. Is that in any way
I don't know. And that's where this all started when I looked in Isaiah at what was said about Emmanuel, because I'm convinced that what happened, what was described in Isaiah, was an event that occurred during the time of Isaiah, but that it genuinely foreshadowed the birth of Jesus. And so what that tells me is there is a phenomenon that God uses of foreshadowing. What I find disturbing about it is there are many things with respect to Emmanuel that were not true with respect to Jesus. There are only certain things with respect to Emmanuel that carry over and are true of Jesus. For instance, Jesus was not named Emmanuel, and the countries of Israel and Syria were not destroyed by the time he was eating milk and curds. So there's some things that are not realized in the life of Jesus, and yet this other event is foreshadowing Jesus. So how do you know what things are carrying over and what things are not? And I find that disturbing. It makes the project of understanding what God is doing a lot more difficult, it seems to me. If it was just a one-to-one analogy, everything that happened to Emmanuel, that's exactly what we see happening with Jesus, I would be much happier. But that's not the kind of phenomenon we're looking at. So we're put in this situation where some of it carries over, but some of it doesn't. And how do you know what's carried over and what's not? And that's tough. That's tough. Yes.
Yeah, more of an observation. I've appreciated just seeing that from Abraham, his covenant, it really is a people of God worshiping Yahweh, but not really understanding that there's only one God yet. And the circumcision was really the only sign that they belonged to Yahweh. So I could see where that is something mm-hmm. that, until you get the Mosaic covenant, it is only circumcision mm-hmm. that identifies them.
That's a good point.
So it's interesting to see the growth of the nation of Israel from Abraham to Moses. I mean, it's 400 plus years.
Yes.
And up until that point, they didn't realize that God was the one and only God.
Right.
And it still grows on into their time and when they get to Palestine, because they still worship other gods. They haven't. Yeah. It's a real growing process.
It is. It definitely is. Yeah. Thanks. That's good.
David, last week you said something toward the end that I found really encouraging, and I wanted to see if you could say more about it. Mm-hmm. And that was, you described a phenomenon, I think you used the word uncommon preparation or something.
Yes.
Was that what you called it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't always turn out the way you anticipate, and you end up doing things you never chose or thought you chose or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you would say more, maybe from your own life or from things that you've observed. Again, it's not really a question, but I just would like to feel that maybe something like that is still happening.
I think it is absolutely the case that that kind of thing is still happening. That God, as the author of history, like I said last week, nothing happens in history that's a surprise to him. He knew a long time before they happened that they were going to happen. And he is doing all kinds of things to prepare the people involved for that thing that is going to happen. And we think in terms of not being ready for an event until we have had the kind of preparation that we think is the right kind of preparation for that thing that happens. And it's just common knowledge, I suppose, what that kind of preparation would be. But the reality is that we oftentimes don't know what the appropriate preparation for event X is. And God is in a position to fully know that. And so he is doing what he needs to do in everybody's life to prepare them for event X. And sometimes it's going to be to prepare us to be a hero in event X. Other times it's going to be to fail in event X. But he's preparing those things. He's getting us just to the place that he wants us, such that event X is what we need next. And I'm confident he's doing that all the time, working on that constantly. It's just hard to see it. We have to take it by faith that that's what he's up to.
And usually event X is not even what we think it's is, or that's not where we think we're headed.
Exactly. One of the things that is so striking in going through this is, like the event the passage we just looked at, what kind of sense does it make? God says to Moses, I'm sending you to Egypt to lead my people out of Egypt. And then he almost kills him. Who would have expected that? That's absurd. And yet that's what God did. And along the line, we're going to see other instances of this. I was talking to Noah about this afternoon. Over the last few years, it's come to the place where I just can't see the rhyme nor reason to celebrating an event, celebrating a victory. Because I have become so accustomed that right after the victory, there's going to be a setback. So where do you get yourself in the clear where you can just celebrate? And I'm having harder time to find those openings where things have come to a conclusion and now I can celebrate. But that's what we're going to see in Exodus too, that there are things that are remarkable that happen, but right after a remarkable thing, there's a setback. And if you're looking at it through Moses' eyes, it's got to be mind-bending to try to deal with all of this stuff that's coming. We'll see in just the next couple passages things that Moses didn't expect to happen. And it's got to do something to his confidence. He's got to be thinking, what is going on here? Did God really send me to do this? It's not working out. I'm convinced that's the norm rather than the exception. Life is just a series of mysterious things. Some we can make sense of and others we can't make sense of. But in all of it, there's enough, I think, to give us confidence that God is doing right by us. He is bringing us along. He is accomplishing his purposes. And we have to really hold on to that because it's easy to lose sight of that and believe things have gotten out of control. This cannot be the way that it should have gone down. Anything else? Okay, we'll just quit here. Thanks.